today on Against the Grain, Harriet Tubman and Andrew Jackson are seminal figures in U.S. history. But how accurate a picture have we been given of them? And what would it mean if Tubman were depicted on U.S. currency? I'm CS. Communications scholar Catherine Squires joins me to shed light on Jackson, Tubman, public memory, and historical truth, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. You're in a store buying something and you pull out your wallet. On the bill you hand to the clerk is an image of Harriet Tubman. Not some white guy, not some long-dead U.S. president, but a black woman, a radical activist and abolitionist. Like the idea? So did, at one point, the U.S. Treasury Department. In 2016, it announced that Tubman would replace Andrew Jackson on the front of the $20 bill. Catherine Squires has used the controversy that followed that announcement to do a number of things: examine how Tubman and Jackson have been portrayed in mainstream narratives, reveal what hasn't been widely disseminated about them, and reflect on what putting Tubman on a U.S. banknote might do or mean. Catherine Squires is professor of communication studies at the University of Minnesota. Her books include The Post-Racial Mystique, Media and Race in the 21st Century, and Dispatches from the Color Line, The Press and Multiracial America. She contributed, with Aisha Upton, an article about Tubman and Jackson to a new volume entitled Racialized Media: The Design, Delivery, and Decoding of Race and Ethnicity. When I connected with Catherine Squires recently, I asked her for details about the U.S. Treasury's 2016 announcement.
During the second term in the Obama administration, the Treasury had put up for discussion putting women on some of the U.S. currency because the currency had to be redesigned for various reasons, foremost of which is, of course, to try to thwart people who are trying to make counterfeit currency, and also because there had been many calls from many quarters to have women on the currency. Some folks remember that Susan B. Anthony was the first woman to appear on modern currency, on the Susan B. Anthony dollar, and that kind of became a joke because people in the U.S. don't normally use dollar coins. And so there was a really big push by many women's groups and others to get women on bills, and particularly on a bill that was at least worth $10 or $20, since those are ones that are so commonly used. It's also interesting that initially they were talking about replacing Alexander Hamilton, but because of the popularity of the musical Hamilton, they decided to focus on a different denomination because all of a sudden people were interested in Alexander Hamilton's background, and that meant that kicking him off the 10 would be more controversial. And so then they switched to thinking about the $20 bill, and eventually they announced that Harriet Tubman would be the first woman to be featured on the front of the $20 bill, and that Andrew Jackson, who is currently on the $20 bill, would be moved to the reverse side in a smaller portrait.
What kind of responses did this announcement by the Treasury Department elicit?
Well, there was quite a lot of variation. There was, of course, there was an organization called Women on the 20s, which was a feminist group that got together to keep the pressure on the Treasury Department to put women on the currency. So they applauded it. A lot of other sort of celebratory feminist congratulations types of messages from people like Oprah and things like this. But there was also a lot of pushback, particularly from Republicans, who said that taking Andrew Jackson off of the $20 bill was just another kind of political correctness, multiculturalism gone amok, disrespectful to a former president, and holding people to standards that they would not have been held to in their own time. And so it's very similar to a lot of the arguments around Confederate monuments today, that we shouldn't, you know, quote unquote, punish people who lived during the time of slavery or fought because of what they believed in the Civil War and hold them to ostensibly a modern day standard that does not fit the times. There were also many African American commentators who thought it was at least suspect to put a woman who had been sold for money and who would have been captured for even more money had she been captured after she escaped from slavery or when she was actively assisting other slaves to escape, that she would become the face of currency. So it was a very interesting spread of reactions that created space for people to talk about contemporary controversies about race and nation.
Yeah, you mentioned Women on 20s, this organization. The title of your article is Redesigning a Pocket Monument. And I guess Women on 20s, some of the organizers there came up with the phrase pocket monument?
Yes. So as part of their argument that it was a serious enough thing to change, that it was symbolic and a sense of belonging and a symbol of the nation, they use this phrase, the pocket monument. It's like having a monument in your pocket to denote the importance of changing the symbols on our money and to really take seriously the notion that it matters how we remember people, how we include various people in the story of what's important in the United States, whose contributions were important enough to honor.
Would Harriet Tubman be the first woman of color to be portrayed on a $20 bill or on any bill?
Well, technically, no. In the modern era, certainly she would be the first to be portrayed on U.S. currency. But I did find in my research for another project that Pocahontas was actually portrayed on an early American banknote. And it was a reproduction of a famous painting that actually is in Washington, D.C., that ostensibly shows her sort of submitting to being baptized. And so that image was engraved on a bill that was in circulation for some time in the 1800s. So Harriet Tubman wouldn't be the first, but she would be the first on the front side of the bill. And she would be the first to be by herself. So again, this portrait of Pocahontas was actually her being baptized into Christianity. And so she's surrounded by all these priests and colonists who are watching this happen in a church. And there's also in the portrait men from her tribe who are there witnessing as well. And it's a very interesting image. I highly recommend people take a look at it because it's also a very problematic image of the story of colonization.
So we're going to talk about Andrew Jackson and Harriet Tubman most of this hour, two very interesting figures in U.S. history. Let's start with Jackson. He is viewed by many as a hero of populist democracy. What's the basis for this belief, and is it accurate?
Well, according to the researchers that I consulted in order to get a sense of Jackson, because again, growing up in the United States as a kid in the 70s and the 80s, this picture of Old Hickory, this sort of folksy, fiery, white-haired guy who went from being a general on the frontier to opening up the White House for a big public party for the everyday person to come into the White House. That's really the myth of Andrew Jackson. Whereas if you look at historians who have done biographies of him in more recent years, and if you look at the actual coverage of his administration and his the actual record, his actual war record, he's actually someone who was quite controversial during his time, not because he expanded the suffrage by any means, not because he was willing to let everyday people into the people's house, but he was controversial because he was known for being a scorched earth tactics general. He was known for disobeying orders from his superiors. He was considered a butcher on the battlefield. He went further into Florida territory, which was at the time Spanish territory and mixed with territories still held by indigenous peoples. He went further than he was supposed to, and he really did use brutal tactics, burning down villages, burning down and salting people's farms and fields to really try and rid the entire Florida Peninsula, not only of indigenous people, but escaped Africans who formed Maroon communities there. So he had a reputation for being bloody, and it's interesting that there's this musical about a so-called founding father, the Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson. So that name really does fit his career. The same thing with the Battle of New Orleans and the other things he's famous for. He's very famous for taking things a few steps further than he was supposed to, that he was ordered to, and for being very defiant and very venge-filled. This is also reflected in his history of participating in multiple duels where he shot other people and was shot by people. So he had a couple of bullets that couldn't get taken out of his body because they were in places where doctors at that time could not surgically remove them safely. So he was a very interesting and thought to be a very violent and volatile person.
The Trail of Tears. So this occurred between 1830 and 1850, and this involved the forced relocation of tens of thousands of Native Americans from their ancestral homelands in the southeastern U.S. Tell us about this. Tell us about where they were forced to march and what happened to many of them.
Many of the indigenous nations of the Southeast were referred to as the civilized tribes, quote unquote. They were amongst them, the Choctaw and the Cherokee were probably the two most, the largest and well-known. And many of them sent their kids to American schools. Many of them, the larger landowners, some of them were also plantation style farmers, and some of them participated in slave owning. But they were sovereign nations, and they held a great big piece of land that other slaveholders, white slaveholders, Andrew Jackson included, and people of his kind wanted that land. Some historians say that because of Jackson's experiences in the Revolutionary War, where he lied about his age to be able to fight as a soldier, he was only 13 or 14 years old, I think, when he joined up. He witnessed the British and their Native American allies, of course, attacking the colonists. And so he had a special hatred for indigenous peoples because of those alliances between the British and certain tribes. And so, according to him, the United States should just never have on its borders or within its borders Native American presence. And so he was determined to push out as many Native Americans as possible. And though the Supreme Court ruled against him and said that it would be in violation of the treaties for this dispossession at this scale to happen, Jackson famously just looked at the court and said, "All right, you've made your ruling, but who's going to enforce it?" And so, being the head of the U.S. Army, being the commander in chief, he just did it on his own, even though it was in defiance of the Supreme Court and in violation of treaties with these different nations. And so they forced people to march towards the territories that we now know of as Oklahoma and parts of Arkansas and Texas. And so many people died, the estimates go anywhere as low as 2,000 up to as high as 10,000. And so basically just trying to empty all of those lands, which of course then left room for large plantations to start to take up the space.
Catherine Squires joins me on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. She is professor of communication studies at the University of Minnesota. And we are talking about an article she contributed with Aisha Upton to the new volume, Racialized Media, The Design, Delivery, and Decoding of Race and Ethnicity. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain. Right, and this is a point you make in your article, which is that there is a connection between colonial expansion within the U.S., the American continent, and the economics of plantation slavery, the system of plantation slavery, and that this connection is often ignored, even by progressive commentators and analysts and academics. So what is that connection?
So plantation economics only work with large tracts of land. If you're going to be a small farmer, just to be really grossly economic about it, having slaves do the work for you is not going to be very economically sound if you're just a small family farm. So that's not to say that some small farmers didn't have slaves. There were plenty of small farmers who had slaves or who hired slaves from larger slave owners to help at certain times of harvest, etc., right? So this isn't like small farmers good, large farmers bad. But the point is, in order to have a large tobacco plantation or a sugar plantation or a cotton plantation, if you want to make a lot of money, you need a lot of land. And you need tons of land so you can rotate crops as well, because these crops, like cotton, take so much out of the soil. It's also back-breaking labor. So you need lots of people. The idea of having slaves do this labor, of course, is something that has been naturalized, right? The idea that Europeans kept importing slaves, and then after the cessation of the slave trade, using methods like sexual exploitation and rape to continue to to make women give birth to people who would be enslaved. So in order to have the land, you have to get rid of the people who are on it. And so because Native Americans, indigenous tribes, controlled so much land that was fertile and would be very economically advantageous for plantation owners, there was lots of foment in the Senate, in the House, by local, state, and governors to continue to dispossess indigenous people. And so when you look at some of the new research that's gone out in the archives, I think Johnson's River of Dark Dreams is one of the best of these. You see how pushing to the Mississippi and beyond becomes really a conversation of slaveholders who are talking about the riches that they would be able to realize if they were able to not only get more new states in the Union where they could buy land, but also if those states would be slave states versus coming into the Union as free. So taking out indigenous people and then installing plantation owners on all that land that came through the Louisiana Purchase, which, by the way, didn't happen with the assent of indigenous people, but with the French who said, we own it. That is one of the engines pushing for that to happen, was Southern slave owners who wanted to keep slavery alive and make sure that it expanded into those new territories where they knew they could grow cotton, they could grow sugar, they could grow tobacco, and they could continue to get very large tracts of land for a very low price if the government basically seized it.
Useful history, important history. And we'll return and talk more about the frenzied imperialism that happened in the course of Andrew Jackson's tenure. Let's talk about Harriet Tubman for a while. There's, of course, a lot to say about her, and she is most famous for her role in the Underground Railroad. So let's start there. Could you remind listeners of the pivotal role she played in ferrying enslaved people? And of course, she was a former enslaved person herself, an escaped enslaved person, ferrying enslaved people to safety.
Right. So Harriet Tubman was born into slavery, and she lived in Maryland and was a slave on a plantation there. And she escaped and returned to help members of her family escape, and then continued to work with a network of abolitionists, black and white, on the East Coast to continue rescuing people and bringing them out of the South. And there's really no exact quantification of how many people she helped to escape. Some people put it in the thousands, other people put it in the hundreds, because of course, it wasn't like someone was keeping a tally, because to do so would be to expose the network of the Underground Railroad. But from oral histories and from documents and letters that various historians have been able to put together, as well as just advertisements, because it was common practice for slave owners to advertise in newspapers in the North. And I found some of Andrew Jackson's advertisements that he placed in Ohio newspapers when his slaves escaped. And so even though they were in the North, many newspapers would publicize bounties on escaped slaves and advertise for slave catchers to help find these people and bring them back into bondage. So with those kinds of sources, historians kind of give this sort of roving estimate of the hundreds to maybe up to 1,000 or more people who were helped directly or indirectly through Harriet Tubman's knowledge, because she was so knowledgeable about different ways of moving through the woods, moving through towns as well as rural areas to escape detection. So this is one of the most famous things about her knowledge, is that she used her remembrances of different pathways to take to get slaves safely to safe houses in order to guide Union soldiers when they were doing raids on Confederate encampments and things like this. So that's where she gets the nickname General Tubman, because when she was working for the Union Army as a spy and a nurse, she used her knowledge of these secret byways and places that wouldn't have a lot of surveillance in order to sneak Union troops to places they wanted to attack.
And when she fled the Maryland plantation on which she was born, and I think she first ended up in Philadelphia, she also used her knowledge, her firsthand knowledge, to speak out against slavery, to advance the abolitionist cause, correct?
Yes, she was on the circuit, so to speak, just like folks like Sojourner Truth and Frederick Douglass and others who had escaped slavery, who are known for their speeches and known for their autobiographies as well, like Frederick Douglass. And so she would, you know, be on stage with other abolitionists, and she would testify about her experiences to large audiences many times. But again, she was a person with a bounty on her head. So even to speak publicly about her experiences was to expose herself to a greater level of risk, because not only would her former quote unquote owners want to bring her back as stolen property, but also there were bounties out for her because she was known to be helping people. And so she was under threat every time she made a trip back, or every time she assisted someone, she was under threat of recapture. So speaking out even in public, and we know from documentation that sometimes abolitionist meetings would be broken up by pro-slavery forces. They would come in, they'd start throwing things, they would start having fights. So it was very, very violent times in the years leading up to the Civil War. So it wasn't just going to talk to people who were having a nice cup of coffee and who had read your slave narrative. It was an act of defiance to speak against slavery in public, even in many places in the North.
You are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Catherine Squires teaches communication studies at the University of Minnesota. Her books include Dispatches from the Color Line, The Press in Multiracial America, and African Americans and the Media. And she has contributed, and we are talking about this article, an article she wrote with Aisha Upton about the 2016 $20 bill controversy. You can find that in the new volume, Racialized Media, edited by Matthew Huey and Emma Gonzalez Lesser, and published by NYU Press. You write that for a long time, public memories of Andrew Jackson and Harriet Tubman have been forged by an epistemology of white ignorance. Now, epistemology has to do with knowledge about the nature and grounds of knowledge. What is white ignorance as defined by the philosopher Charles Mills?
So Charles Mills, whose idea of white ignorance, his theory of white ignorance, we drew upon pretty extensively. And the reason why we turn to this concept is because it provides a really helpful and, I think, easy to understand rubric for why certain parts of our history just seem to have been forgotten. So if we think about the ways that the Confederate monument controversies are playing out right now, some people say, well, like, how can we even be arguing about this in the 21st century? And I think the paradigm of white ignorance helps us understand this, because white ignorance is a systemic facet of white supremacy. Because of the institutional control of education, museums, and other sites where you might learn about history, because of the ways that African Americans, Indigenous Americans have been kept out of institutions of higher learning until very recently, the accepted ways of writing about history, the accepted ways of getting things published, have been under the control of white Americans. This is just basic stuff. And because of that, you have generations upon generations of people reading stories that are 100% from the point of view of white people who are justifying their control of all these resources. So because there has not been traditionally, historically, a parallel set of stories as easily accessed as those white-dominated stories, it makes it easy for people to claim ignorance about the violence of the past. It makes it easy and, you know, in some ways understandable for people to say, I had no idea that for so long African Americans have had such a different experience of police. I had no idea that for so long African Americans had such a different experience of educational institutions. These blind spots are actually meant to happen, right? These blind spots are part of the program because, you know, just to be very blunt, right? To the victor goes the spoils, right? Who gets to tell the story of the battle? The people who won it, not the people who are dead. And so because of just that kind of basic framework, and again, the active exclusion of people of color stories from the history books, you get a system that perpetuates the naturalness of white dominance because there's no counter narrative to say it could have been otherwise, or there were other people around who could have done differently. And so in that absence of other testimonies in the absence of other evidence, then it's just easier to be ignorant.
That's my guest, Catherine Squires. We're going to take a short break and speak more with her about Andrew Jackson and Harriet Tubman and public memory and much more. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Catherine Squires is Professor of Communication Studies at the University of Minnesota. She is the author most recently of The Post-Racial Mystique, Media and Race in the 21st Century. She's also the editor of Dangerous Discourses, Feminism, Gun Violence, and Civic Life. We are talking about an article, a chapter she contributed with Aisha Upton to a new volume called Racialized Media, The Design, Delivery, and Decoding of Race and Ethnicity. So as this controversy in 2016 was unfolding after, just to remind listeners who might have joined us recently, that the U.S. Treasury Department announced that Harriet Tubman would be featured on the new $20 bill as part of a redesign for 2020. By the way, those plans have since been put on hold. What would happen is that what was planned to happen was that Tubman's image would be featured and Andrew Jackson, who currently is the focus of the $20 bill, his portrait would be moved to the reverse side of the bill, placed in a smaller frame. So in the midst of this controversy, a senator, a Virginia Democrat named Jim Webb, he defended Andrew Jackson against charges of genocide by asserting that Jackson brought an orphaned Native American baby from the battlefield to his home, to Jackson's home in Tennessee, and raised him as his, as Jackson's son. True?
Yes, that is true. Jackson did accept a child who was found beneath his dead mother's body, according to legend. A soldier on the battlefield. This was one of these battles where Jackson led his men into a village and slaughtered everyone, men, women, and children. And a soldier found a baby, allegedly underneath his mother's dead body, and brought him to Jackson's tent. And Jackson brought him home. He and his wife never had children of their own. They served as sort of foster parents for some of their nephews. And they brought this child home and raised him as a quote-unquote companion to the other boys. They did not send him to West Point as they did his white foster brothers. They sent him to be an apprentice to a tanner. And if you know anything about tanning, you know that tanning involves a lot of nasty chemicals. So to be a tanner is someone who creates leather from dead animals. So it's not the nicest job in the world. So they sent him to be the apprentice to a tanner. And then he died of illness at a fairly young age, as a teenager, and he was buried somewhere on the property, but he was not buried in the family plot, and he doesn't have a headstone.
I see. So we are getting only part of the truth there. And part of the truth is what we've been getting about Harriet Tubman as well. You write that she is frequently portrayed as the ultimate magical Negro. And this, I guess, is on the big screen as well as in other media portrayals. What do you mean by that?
There have been some good content analyses of portrayals of Harriet Tubman in children's literature and also in history books for young students. And they portray her as this like feisty old lady who, you know, secretly snuck back and forth across the Mason-Dixon line and freed a few slaves and smoked a corncob pipe and, you know, died after a long, long life. So they leave out that she struggled her entire life. It wasn't like the Union won the Civil War and then she just was able to, you know, live the life of luxury and accolade that she deserved. She had to fight for decades to get her war pension. So her husband fought in the war, and when he died, she was owed a widow's pension. But like many other African-American soldiers and their families, that was not forthcoming from the War Department. Likewise, because she served as a nurse and a spy in the war, she was supposed to get a soldier's pension. And indeed, in probably one of the most disappointing and disheartening things I read about Harriet Tubman, she had her papers from the War Department, and she got on a train, and she was sitting in a car because she had bought a ticket that was for a particular car. And the white conductor of the train literally threw her out of the car. Did not believe that Harriet Tubman could possibly have been a veteran because she was a black woman, right? She couldn't possibly have been a veteran in any capacity of the Civil War. So they accused her of having false papers and also sitting in a place where a black person should not be sitting. Eventually, he recruited two other men on the train to forcibly remove her from her seat, and they threw her into the baggage car. And she was trapped in the baggage car for the rest of the train trip. She was going to upstate New York. And the people meeting her at the platform reported that her arm was dislocated from being thrashed around in the baggage car. So when people tell the story of Harriet Tubman and they end it with her triumphantly helping the Union Army defeat the Confederates, they are leaving out decades of her activism and self-advocacy, not only to get what was owed to her for her service, but also to build a home in New York for formerly enslaved people who were sick, orphaned, or elderly to be able to live in dignity for the rest of their days.
So in this article, you present a kind of a content analysis. You and Upton examined both mainstream and people of color-oriented news sources to see the ways in which Tubman, Jackson, and the $20 bill controversy were discussed. And we certainly don't have time to go into the results of your analysis, although I think people can get a sense of some of your conclusions from your comments thus far this hour. But I did want to ask you, because I found them rather compelling, and I think you did too, about the commentaries of two people, the writer and activist Feminista Jones and the journalist Stephen Thrasher. What position did they take with respect to the announcement that Harriet Tubman would be featured on the $20 bill?
Right. So those writers were of the camp that it wasn't really an honor to put Harriet Tubman on the $20 bill, because that would be to try to wrap her in capitalism. And you can read her story as an anti-capitalist story, because if you think about the ways that slavery was so entwined with the American capitalist system, the way that fortunes were made, the way that contracts were made, the way that people's citizenship and ability to own property versus be property was set up, that her fight to be free, her fight to keep people out of that aspect of our capitalist system, means that you're doing a disservice to her memory by putting her on the currency for which she would be traded and making her a symbol of capitalism, and knowing how, you know, if you extrapolate from the work she did during her life, particularly after the Civil War, and she went through periods where she was impoverished herself, where she could not find employment, where she had to depend on charity at times, where she had to sell versions of her story to people who, you know, put in things that may or may not have been true. She was exploited by capitalism. And so to make her a symbol of capitalist enterprise for them was an insult. But again, they used the announcement as an opportunity to also bring forward the ways that Black people in particular, but workers in general, have not made progress in terms of well-being, in terms of health, education, social mobility under the current iteration of American capitalism, that there's still huge gaps in employment and wealth for African Americans and other people of color compared to white Americans, and that slavery is part of the reason for that. And so they did use their columns as an opportunity not only to cast a question about whether or not it was really an honor to put her on the $20 bill, but also to use the opportunity to begin a critique of how capitalism continues to be so racially skewed today.
The voice of Catherine Squire is professor of communication studies at the University of Minnesota. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. What proportion, if you happen to remember, what proportion of commentators in people of color-oriented news sources, what proportion of them supported putting Tubman on the bill as opposed to opposed that?
So the great majority supported it, particularly in publications like Ebony or Black Enterprise, Oprah's magazine. People supported it because it was framed as a first. Both in the mainstream media and in people of color media, most folks did say this is an honor that's long overdue, or we should have had a woman, whether or not it's Harriet Tubman, we should have had women on the currency long before now, right? And Harriet Tubman is a great choice because X, Y, and Z. So these critical voices who said, actually, we should really be thinking about whether or not Harriet Tubman would endorse the idea of this at all, and whether or not putting her on currency is an actual honor. That was a minority of the minority, shall we say.
And do you have any opinion or judgment about that?
For me personally, I think Harriet Tubman should be honored in lots of different ways. I don't think putting her on currency is the first thing that I would have thought of in terms of what to do. And certainly I have appreciated some other very interesting and comedic takes on the idea of Harriet Tubman on the $20 bill making racists mad that they have to use money that has this Black woman's face on it. So there's one columnist who imagined this scenario where somebody goes to an ATM and they just can't believe they have to actually use this money because it offends their racist sensibilities. So that was kind of fun to read that. So I can see the different vantage points, but I also think that because of the general ignorance about her life, that it would be all too easy for people to wrap her image on the $20 bill into this sort of American exceptionalism narrative where she just becomes this exceptional individual who deserves this honor because she did these amazing, exceptional things, which then resonates with other narratives about Black American celebrities, which is you're the exception to the rule. Other Black people haven't gotten their stuff together, and you're an exception because you are a great sports star, or you went to this university, or you did this extraordinary thing. So for the time being, we can lift you up, but you're an exception. And so I think that's the biggest danger in these kinds of things. And you see it with folks, you know, taking Martin Luther King's words out of context, for example, or picking and choosing to talk about the March on Washington speech, but not his speech against the war in Vietnam. So, you know, we have that pattern in the way we think about public history and the way that mainstream media and textbooks, quite frankly, portray African Americans who have struggled for human rights, for Black rights. And again, we still have this issue, you know, Senator Tom Cotton saying we shouldn't even let people teach the 1619 Project. That's a very extraordinary statement, but it's also one that echoes a longer line of reactionary politics when people of color start writing history. Lynn Cheney was at the forefront in the 1980s and the 1990s trying to push back changes to history textbooks that talked about colonization as a brutal process, because it was, that talked about slavery beyond, you know, a few pictures of escaped slaves and then, oh, Civil War, we're done. So this has been a long battle to reframe American history so that the perspectives of people like Harriet Tubman, so that the perspectives of people like the folks who were force marched by Andrew Jackson on the Trail of Tears are actually more in the center versus just like, oh, sad that happened, footnote. It totally changes the way we tell the story of what it means to be a United States citizen when we include those kinds of voices. It changes the way we think about the other people who are on the statues, on the money, and other places where they're being honored if we know the fuller story. And then the question becomes, what else do we need to do in terms of our regimes of representation to make all of these stories accessible so that people can't keep claiming surprise that these kinds of patterns continue to recur?
Yeah, and just as you were saying, when the media or a Hollywood film, for example, portrays a, quote, exceptional African-American, the question that is encouraged, as you write, is if this African-American could rise above her or his or their circumstances, why can't other African-Americans?
Right. And that's a pattern that I think filmmakers like Ava DuVernay, for example, are really pushing against. And so you have a new generation of filmmakers that have really kicked down the door, and actors and actresses and producers now. So you've got a new generation of people who are able to tell different kinds of stories and who are able to center different kinds of narratives that aren't just the exceptional person. And that really matters. So if you compare Selma to Mississippi Burning, it's a very different kind of narrative about what the violence of the civil rights movement was about, right? Instead of focusing on two main white characters, as happens in Mississippi Burning, she focuses on the whole community of people that had to be involved in order to make those marches happen. So you see a completely different way of thinking, or even thinking about, you know, the recently departed John Lewis and the way that the graphic novel March really took the world by storm, where people said, oh, wow, like we never knew any of these things. And to center his story and to center the way that he learned and came up in a community of activists, and exposing people to a much longer list of names is just something you couldn't have imagined happening, you know, when I was growing up as a kid. So, you know, when people say, oh, you know, don't bother about this, don't bother about this, it's just representation, it's just representation. Yes, and those representations provide a backdrop and assumptions about who is important, which stories are important for us to remember, because we're supposed to learn something about what's right, what's wrong, what kind of action should we take if we see an injustice, what kinds of injustices are worth taking action about versus ignoring. And it's going to be very interesting, but it's going to continue to be a struggle, because what we learn about the past is part of us planning for the future. And what we think of as possible is partly predicated on what we think people like us have been able to do in the past. And so if we don't learn the vast range of things that we've been able to accomplish in the past, then it's harder to imagine a future where we're able to build even more.
Catherine Squires, professor at the University of Minnesota. You may want to check out her books, The Post-Racial Mystique, Media and Race in the 21st Century, Dispatches from the Color Line, and African Americans and the Media. And you may want to check out the article we've been talking about today that she co-authored and contributed to the new volume, Racialized Media, The Design, Delivery, and Decoding of Race and Ethnicity, edited by Matthew Huey and Emma Gonzalez-Lesser, published by NYU Press. Catherine, thanks so much for your work and for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on the show.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.